From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now!
That video is graphic and horrific and terrible, and no person should do that. But my job in the end is to prove that he violated a criminal statute. And there is other evidence that does not support a criminal charge.
The streets of Minneapolis as protests against the police killing of George Floyd rocked the city for the third night in a row, after prosecutors say they're not sure yet if they'll criminally charge Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who kneeled on Floyd's neck while he gasped repeatedly, "I can't breathe." We'll go to Minneapolis to speak with City Council member Jeremiah Ellison. Police pointed an automatic rifle at his head in 2015 when he was peacefully protesting yet another police killing of another African-American man named Jamar Clark. We'll also speak with Candace Montgomery with the Black Visions Collective, which is calling for the abolition of police. Then, as the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic shifts to Latin America, so too does the use of COVID-19 as a pretext for police repression.
We are people who are detained illegally for 45 days. We are asking authorities to free us.
We'll look at a new report on police repression by Amnesty International and go to El Salvador. Finally, President Trump calls Minneapolis protesters thugs and tweets, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Twitter flags the tweet with a warning: it glorifies violence, just as Trump signs an executive order to punish social media companies for how they monitor content. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands took to the streets of Minneapolis Thursday as protests against the killing of an African-American man by a white police officer rocked the city for the third night in a row. Demonstrators set fire to the Minneapolis Police Department's third precinct just hours after prosecutors said they're not sure yet if they'll criminally charge Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who pinned George Floyd to the ground by his neck for 8 minutes while Floyd gasped for air. In a video that's now been seen around the world, Floyd repeatedly gasps, "I can't breathe." Four officers, including Chauvin, have since been fired but not arrested. On Thursday, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman was questioned about the delay in charging and arresting the officers.
That video is graphic and horrific and terrible, and no person should do that. But my job in the end is to prove that he violated a criminal statute. And there is other evidence that does not support a criminal charge.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called in the National Guard overnight as protests raged in Minneapolis and St. Paul. This morning, Minnesota State Patrol arrested CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez, along with his producer and camera crew, live on national television outside the charred remains of the 3rd Police Precinct. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz later apologized to CNN over the arrests, and the crew was released. After headlines, we'll go to Minneapolis for the latest. Around the United States, thousands of people took to the streets to protest the police killing of George Floyd. Here in New York, police arrested at least 70 people during a rolling protest that began in Manhattan's Union Square. In Colorado, police fired tear gas and pepper balls at protesters who gathered at the state capitol in Denver. One protester was intentionally rammed by a driver who plowed their SUV into a crowd of demonstrators. In Arizona, police declared an unlawful assembly Thursday and fired tear gas and pepper spray at hundreds who gathered at Phoenix City Hall. In Louisville, Kentucky, hundreds of protesters gathered downtown demanding justice for Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old aspiring nurse who was shot to death by police inside her own apartment in March. At least 7 people were injured by gunfire that erupted as demonstrators surrounded a police vehicle. It's not known who fired the shots, though Louisville's mayor said no police officers fired their weapons. On Twitter, President Trump attacked Minneapolis's mayor, who called for the arrest of now-fired police officer Derek Chauvin over the killing of George Floyd. Trump tweeted, "I can't stand back and watch this happen to a great American city, Minneapolis. A total lack of leadership. Either the very weak radical left mayor, Jacob Frey, get his act together and bring the city under control, or I'll send in the National Guard and get the job done right," Trump wrote. In a follow-up tweet, Trump attacked protesters as thugs, adding, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Twitter responded by labeling Trump's tweet with the warning, quote, "This tweet violated the Twitter rules about glorifying violence. However, Twitter has determined that it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible," unquote. On Thursday, President Trump signed an executive order that could be used to punish social media companies, including Twitter, for how they monitor content. This comes after Twitter Tuesday took the unprecedented step of adding a fact-check label to two tweets in which Trump erroneously attacked mail-in voting. Meanwhile, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg Thursday defended his company's refusal to regulate misinformation, including false and deceptive political advertisements. Zuckerberg spoke to CNBC.
"I don't think that Facebook or internet platforms in general should be arbiters of truth. I think that's a kind of a dangerous line to get down to in terms of deciding what is true and what isn't."
Later in the broadcast, we'll have more on President Trump's attacks on social media with UCLA professor Ramesh Srinivasan. The U.S. Labor Department reported another 2.1 million workers filed for unemployment benefits over the last week, bringing the total of job losses since coronavirus lockdowns began in mid-March to a staggering 40.7 million. One in four U.S. workers has lost their job in just 10 weeks. The Institute for Policy Studies reports during the same period, the combined wealth of U.S. billionaires soared by $485 billion. California recorded its largest one-day jump in coronavirus cases since the pandemic began, with over 2,600 new infections reported Thursday. California passed the grim milestone of 100,000 confirmed cases this week, as Santa Clara County Health Officer Dr. Sarah Cody, who issued the nation's first shelter-in-place order in March, warned California is reopening its economy too quickly. Meanwhile, public health officials in San Francisco say the coronavirus pandemic has indirectly led to a spike in the deaths of unhoused people. Since the end of March, at least 48 unhoused people have died in the city, up from 14 people during the same period last year. Dr. Rupa Marya of the Do No Harm Coalition said, quote, "These excess deaths I see as COVID deaths, whether or not they were from the virus or from the complete failure of the COVID response from the city. They were deaths that would not have happened otherwise." Meanwhile, coronavirus cases are surging in southern states, including Arkansas, Alabama, and Mississippi. The increases came even as Politico reported health departments around the United States have inflated testing numbers or deflated death tallies by changing criteria for who counts as a coronavirus victim and what counts as a coronavirus test. In Pennsylvania, a Democratic state legislator has accused some of his Republican colleagues of covering up their COVID-19 status and potentially putting other lawmakers at risk. A video of State Representative Brian Sims talking about the situation has gone viral.
"First of all, Mike Terzai, the Speaker of the House, needs to resign. And any member of leadership that has known what was going on, any member of Republican leadership that knew that members were testing positive, that other members were being quarantined, and did not tell those of us who were exposed to those members, needs to be investigated by the Attorney General. And I think that there needs to be prosecutions."
In immigration news, advocates across the country are continuing demands to release all people from immigration and customs enforcement jails as confirmed coronavirus cases inside these jails in the U.S. near 1,400. Immigrant rights advocates led protests outside immigration jails in California and Washington State Thursday. In Burlington, Massachusetts, advocates replaced the ICE flag at the agency's Boston field office with a new flag that read, "ICE kills, free them all." Another National Day of Action is planned for today. Meanwhile, a 30-year-old undocumented Mexican immigrant who sued Immigration and Customs Enforcement 2 weeks ago and was later quickly deported by the agency has officially been declared missing. Hector Garcia Mendoza was part of a class-action lawsuit demanding the immediate release of all immigrants held at the Elizabeth Contract Detention Facility in New Jersey, where prisoners and staff have tested positive for COVID-19. Gothamist reports 4 days later and without notice, Garcia Mendoza was transferred to Laredo, Texas, where he was then escorted into the notoriously dangerous border town of Nuevo Laredo, Mexico. Garcia Mendoza reportedly has not reached out to his family in Mexico or the United States. His lawyers have contacted shelters in Mexico and immigrant advocacy groups in Texas, but no one's reportedly seen or heard from him. His family's also concerned for Garcia Mendoza's health, as in the days leading up to his removal, he complained of chest pain and shortness of breath, but did not receive any medical attention from ICE. Mendoza's removal came despite a federal judge's order blocking the deportation. Advocates believe his expedited deportation is retaliation for the lawsuit against ICE. Garcia Mendoza had been living in the United States for 10 years. In Iowa, Tyson Foods says it'll halt operations at its Storm Lake meat processing plant after over 550 workers, or more than 20% of the workforce, tested positive for the coronavirus. Buena Vista County, where the plant's located, has the highest per capita infection rate of COVID-19 in Iowa. In California, over 200 workers at 8 Los Angeles area meat and food processing plants have tested positive for COVID-19. John Grant, president of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770, which represents the meat packers, called on Smithfield Foods to close its Farmer John plant near downtown Los Angeles.
The outbreak is over 10% of the workforce, and it's dangerous. And the problem with this is that it's invisible, insidious, and deadly. And so what you do is, when a shark's in the water, you pull everybody out of the water and you make an assessment of what's going on.
In April, President Trump invoked the Defense Production Act to order meatpacking plants around the United States to remain open. The plants are home to many of the largest coronavirus hotspots in the United States. Dozens of COVID-19 deaths are tied to meat factories. Brazil registered a record number of COVID-19 cases Thursday, with more than 1,000 deaths in just 24 hours. Brazil, second only to the United States in infections and deaths, as far-right President Jair Bolsonaro has sought throughout the pandemic to undermine remain-at-home measures taken by state and local governments. Despite this week's surge in COVID-19 cases, the mayor of Sao Paulo, the Western Hemisphere's largest city, is allowing non-essential businesses, including offices, shopping malls, and car dealerships, to reopen beginning June 1st. In Haiti, local social justice and human rights groups are warning hundreds of prisoners could be at risk of dying of COVID-19 as infections are quickly spreading inside Haiti's prisons. The Miami Herald reports at least 11 prisoners at the National Penitentiary in Port-au-Prince have already tested positive. Many others are presenting symptoms such as fevers. But Haitian human rights groups believe the number of infections is far higher as prisons are overcrowded with scarce food supplies or essential medication, and up to 80 prisoners are reportedly often crammed shoulder to shoulder inside filthy cells without ventilation. The United States has also faced criticism for deporting Haitians who've tested positive for the coronavirus. The Trump administration's announced plans to cancel the visas of thousands of Chinese graduate students studying in the United States. The move would impact students who've studied at schools that have links to the Chinese military. Republican lawmakers are also proposing to bar all Chinese graduate students from studying science or technology in the United States. Many educators have warned the moves could lead to a new red scare on American campuses. Meanwhile, Britain's considering offering a path to citizenship for over 300,000 Hong Kong residents if China moves ahead with implementing a new national security law on the former British colony. In news from Capitol Hill, Democrats have pulled a bill to reauthorize parts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act after members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and the Republican minority formed an unlikely coalition opposing the legislation. President Trump had threatened to veto the bill, which would have extended FISA, that's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, until 2023. And in more fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, the next major round of the UN climate change talks has been pushed back a full year to November 2021. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands took to the streets of Minneapolis Thursday as protests against the police killing of George Floyd rocked the city for the third night in a row. Demonstrators set fire to a police precinct just hours after prosecutors said they were not sure yet if they would criminally charge Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who pinned African-American man George Floyd to the ground by his neck for 8 minutes while Floyd gasped for air. In a video that's now been seen around the world, Floyd repeatedly gasps, "I can't breathe." The four officers, including Chauvin, have since been fired, but not arrested. On Thursday, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman was questioned about the delay in charging and arresting the officers involved in the killing of George Floyd.
"That video is graphic and horrific and terrible, and no person should do that. But my job in the end is to prove that he violated a criminal statute. And there is other evidence that does not support a criminal charge. We have to do this right. We have to prove it in a court of law. And I will just point to you the comparison to what happened in Billy in Baltimore in the Gray case. It was a rush to charge. It was a rush to justice. And all of those people were found not guilty. I will not rush to justice. I'm going to do this right. And those folks who know me in the African community know I will do my very level best. But I will not rush justice because justice cannot be rushed."
George Floyd's murder sparked an uprising in Minneapolis as some protesters lit fires and destroyed building fronts. Solidarity actions brought thousands to the streets of Los Angeles, Phoenix, Denver, Columbus, Ohio, and Louisville, Kentucky. At least seven people were shot while protesting the police killing of a black woman, Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old aspiring nurse who was shot to death by police inside her own apartment in March. Gunfire erupted as demonstrators surrounded a police vehicle Thursday night there. It's unclear who fired the shots. Back in Minnesota, the governor, Tim Walz, has called in the National Guard as mass protests rage in St. Paul and Minneapolis. On Twitter, President Trump called for violence, calling protesters thugs and threatening, quote, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Twitter responded by flagging Trump's tweet, warning this tweet violated the Twitter rules about glorifying violence. However, Twitter has determined that it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible, unquote. In another tweet, Trump attacked Minneapolis's mayor, Jacob Frey, who's called for the arrest of now-fired police officer Derek Chauvin over the killing of George Floyd, which the mayor called murder. Gwen Carr, the mother of Eric Garner, traveled to Minneapolis and spoke at a vigil Thursday at the spot where George Floyd was killed.
"As you know, this happened to me almost 6 years ago. And this is just opening up an old wound, pouring salt into it. They keep coming into the police officers come into our neighborhoods. They brutalize. They terrorize. They murder our children. And we have done nothing."
Good. Protests in Minneapolis are ongoing. This morning, the Minnesota State Patrol arrested CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez, along with his producer and camera crew, live on national television outside the charred remains of the 3rd Police Precinct. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz later apologized to CNN over the arrest. The crew was released, and Omar was reporting on the streets an hour and a half later. The cover of today's Minneapolis Star Tribune reads, "State of Agony." That agony expressed in this short excerpt of the damning video of the officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd. This is a warning. This is extremely graphic and violent. We are only showing it to show the extreme nature of what has happened.
"I cannot breathe.
You're just a grown guy. You're a tough guy. You're a tough guy. You're not even resisting arrest, bro.
His whole nose is
fought with him.
Why are you just sitting there? He ain't doing nothing. Right now. Put him in the car."
For more, we're joined by two guests, Candace Montgomery executive director of Black Visions Collective, a Black-led queer and trans-centering community organization based in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and Jeremiah Ellison, Minneapolis City Council member. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jeremiah, let's begin with you. Can you respond to everything that has taken place, beginning with that video that authorities do not want people to see? Some of the authorities, though the mayor himself of Minneapolis, has called the killing of George Floyd by the police officer murder.
I think the mayor is absolutely right on that point. I think it was murder. I think that's evident from the video. And not only on Officer Chauvin's part, but I think that the three officers aiding him in the murder of George Floyd should also face charges for what transpired there, what happened there. You know, I think that obviously the Minneapolis is in a state of unrest, and while the protests might not be unfolding in the way that I would personally like, I think that our response, the police response to protesters, has been so brutal. Especially early on, before things were violent, our police force responded in a way that was so brutal. It's hard for me to say that we have any moral ground to stand on when it comes to those calls for peace that I've seen from some of my colleagues.
I mean, some people may have been wondering from seeing this video where the other two officers are. You've got Chauvin with his knee on the neck of George Floyd. You've got Tao, the officer standing next to him. Apparently, Chauvin has something like 18 complaints against him. Tao, something like six. Where the other two are, new video has surfaced of the other two officers holding down George Floyd right next to, but behind the police car, right next to Chauvin.
I think that they are as complicit in this murder as the first two officers, and I think that they need to be held accountable for that.
So you have the four officers. How is it possible that they have not been arrested yet? We're not talking about convicted or tried, but you look at what happened with George Floyd himself. He was being arrested by police. That happened suddenly. Yet after days of this video being out, even in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, the authorities did not want that video out. They had it for months. It's the horror of authorities when a video like this gets out. But within a few days of it getting out, the retired officer and his son and another person involved were charged with murder. What's happening in Minneapolis, and what do you make of the Hennepin County attorney, Mike Hennepin, saying there may be exonerating evidence?
I think it's completely inappropriate. I think that the video is self-evident, and I think that the ball is in the district attorney's hands, and that he needs to move forward with what we're seeing in that video. And if he wants to sort of pass on that duty to other state law enforcement, I think that he should do that. But I think that every day that we delay justice, you know, we're potentially denying justice. And I think that the public certainly feels that way. And you're seeing that in the protests.
I want to bring Candace Montgomery into this conversation. You're with the Minneapolis organization, Black Visions. Talk about what you're demanding. Have you been in the streets? Can you respond to what's happening there? And can you describe for us when you first saw this video, Candace?
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Right now, Black Visions, as well as Reclaim the Block and other community members are, and for the last several years, have been calling on our city council and mayor to divest from the police and invest in community-led safety solutions. We want justice for George Floyd, and we know that justice isn't enough. And now is the time to defund the police and invest in community. And I was on the streets, not last night, the night before, for some time. I actually live with my dad, who is really vulnerable to COVID-19. And so I've had to figure out ways to keep myself safe so that I can still care for him. But yeah, I was there witnessing the rebellion being led by young Black and brown folks. Upon seeing the video, I haven't really watched the full video because I feel like I've honestly seen enough of those. But the murder did happen two blocks from my home. Cup Foods is actually my regular, you know, corner deli. Yeah.
So describe when you saw the video. And I wanted to ask both you and Councilmember Ellison about the showing of the video. I mean, we're seeing the fires repeatedly, but what has provoked it, this horrific film? How do you feel about it being shown on television?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have complicated feelings. I think it's really important that especially people who are not Black, who do not live in the terror and violence of police departments across the country and across the globe on a daily basis, really need to see the hard truths that Black kids grow up with and that Black people see on a regular basis. As well, I think that it's concerning the ways that we're so willing to broadcast Black death and how are we actually honoring those folks that we are losing. So I feel really mixed about it. I think there are many benefits to being able to see these. The same thing with Philando. Having these videos, have mobilized and activated community members and have led to real change.
And also, Councilmember Ellison, your thoughts.
I think I share really similar thoughts on an emotional level. I never want to see the video, and I never want to see somebody's last moments, especially when in their last moments they are there's an attempt to deny their dignity, such as the case with George Floyd. I never want to see that shown to the public. But often it is the emergency of these videos that even gets us a chance at the pursuit of justice.
I wanted to go back to a time a few years ago, ask you about the police killing of 24-year-old African-American Jamar Clark, November 2015. During a protest at the 4th Precinct Police Station, an officer dressed in fatigues and carrying what appeared to be a gas-launching gun pointed his weapon at you as you stood with your hands up. At the time, you had long dregs, Jeremiah. A Star Tribune photographer captured the moment, and your dad, then Congressmember Keith Ellison, who's now the Attorney General of Minnesota, tweeted, writing, "Photo is agonizing for me to see. My son is peacefully protesting with hands up, officer shouldering gun. Why?" And he spoke about it on Democracy Now! At the time.
Well, my first reaction when I saw the picture of Jeremiah was horror. I would gladly face whatever dangers that were necessary, but to have my son have to face it is another thing. He's a 24-year-old guy. He's has a strong passion for justice. He's a professional artist. And he doesn't think he needs his dad worrying about him like that. But I can't help it. I remember when he was just a little boy, and now he's a grown man. And I actually am a little proud that he feels this burning desire to stand up for what's right and to make a better society. But yet, that picture was very, very disturbing. And we're not going to let it sit there. I mean, to shoulder a weapon like that at nonviolent protesters is outrageous. It's a violation of decency, and we're going to find out whether it's a violation.
Who
of
is
law.
The author? So that's Keith Ellison, former Congress member, first Muslim member of Congress, now the Attorney General of Minnesota. And Jeremiah, at the time, you were protesting in the streets nearby the 3rd Precinct at the 4th Precinct. Can you talk about this arc of your life from standing in the streets protesting the police killing of Jamar Clark to now being a city council member and you're protesting a similar killing?
Yeah. You know, what I think is really interesting about the last couple of years since that incident occurred is that you know, I showed up there as a neighbor. You know, my dad mentioned that I'm an artist, and that's, I have my art studio, and I grew up in the neighborhood that I now represent. And I wasn't sort of one of the organizers of the event. And as a matter of fact, Candace was one of the main organizers who was really holding it down, and who was somebody I really sought guidance from at the Fourth Precinct occupation. You know, I think that while I've always been involved in politics, and while I've always had you know, sort of this desire to pursue justice, that event really politicized me in a major way, and it made me realize that we need leaders to be more creative, more bold in pursuing and ensuring that kind of thing doesn't happen again.
Finally, I want to ask both of you, starting with Candace Montgomery, as we wrap up, what you're demanding right now. The four officers have been fired, but they haven't been charged. What are you demanding happen to them and overall around the issue of police brutality?
Right now, we are really honing in on a demand to the mayor and the city council to defund the police. We want justice for George Floyd, and we think accountability with the officers is really necessary. And too often, we just lean on that accountability and feed more into a prison system that continues to be harmful to all of our communities. And so now is really the time for the Minneapolis City Council and mayor to defund the police and invest in community. As well, we are calling for the Minneapolis Police Department to acknowledge the harm of their institution and the ways that it has violated the dignity and rights of Black communities and families, make an official apology, and then continue the work.
And to And let me also ask you, Candace, Tamika Mallory and others have been warning people about provocateurs on the streets, and I'm wondering your thoughts on this.
Absolutely. I think that is always a real issue. We know the history of COINTELPRO and other state-led interventions to quiet and quell Black organizing and rebellion. And so I think it's very important that folks who are on the streets are being wary of who's actually aligned with the values and the reasons why they are out there and who's not.
And finally, your final response, Jeremiah Ellison, also with the CNN whole camera crew being arrested. They were there when there were no police at the fires early this morning around 4 o'clock, around 3 o'clock. And then he showed the local police moving in. And before they even landed on the ground, getting out of their police cars, they were tear gassing people who were on the sidewalk. CNN was showing all of this, and then Omar Jimenez himself was handcuffed and taken in, and he himself, when he came out, said, you know, he understood that the reason he's out on the street now is because the images were shown of him being arrested, as he reasonably said, what do you want us to do, to the state patrol who had moved in?
I think it's inexcusable. I think not only what happened to the CNN reporters, but, you know, again, at the beginning of this protest, there were protesters who were being sprayed with mace unprovoked by our officers. I think that some of our city leadership has struggled to clarify whether officers are acting rogue or whether this is a part of the plan. I know that I've called that into question. I've demanded that we take a different approach, and that and that demand has sort of fallen on deaf ears. And
City Council member, you had Josh Campbell, the white CNN reporter, not arrested, narrating what was happening to the reporter of color of CNN, Omar Jimenez. But finally, President Trump calling the protesters thugs. And then saying, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, his tweet being flagged with a warning by Twitter saying it encourages violence. Your response to the president of the United States?
Well, I'm ready to make sure that we keep the residents of Minneapolis safe. That's including from the president. And I think that that while the way that a protest unfolds might be not it might not be neat. It might be some might consider it unsightly. But at the end of the day, we're seeing damage to property, and he's talking about shooting and killing people, citizens, residents of our city. I think it's completely inappropriate, and it's not anything that I would welcome in Minneapolis.
Jeremiah Ellison, I want to thank you for being with us, city council member of Minneapolis, and Candace Montgomery, executive director of Black Visions Collective, a Black-led queer and trans-centering community organization based in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Next up, as the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic shifts to Latin America, so too does the use of COVID-19 as a pretext for police repression. We'll look at a new Amnesty International report. Stay with us.
We who believe in freedom and not rest until until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom and not rest. We who believe in freedom and not freedom cannot rest. That which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people, passing on to others that
Ella Song by Sweet Honey in the Rock. Ella for Ella Baker, the great human rights leader. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic shifts to Latin America, so too does the use of COVID-19 as a pretext for police repression. A new report by Amnesty International details the increasing use of arbitrary, punitive, violent attacks in Latin America and the Caribbean as governments enforce coronavirus lockdowns and restrictions. In El Salvador, hundreds of people detained in government facilities allegedly aimed at curbing the spread of the coronavirus have protested to demand to be freed and be given the results of their COVID-19 tests. This is a group of people who say they've been held in one of San Salvador's quarantine detention centers for over 45 days. This footage was published last week by a Central American human rights organization.
We are people who are detained illegally for 45 days. We are asking authorities to free us. We have been tested for the coronavirus four times and tested negative all four times. But the authorities still say there is a COVID-19 positive person among us, which is completely false. We demand answers of how it is possible there is a positive case among us after being detained illegally for 45 days.
Well, for more, we're going to San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, where we're joined by Jorge Cuellar, assistant professor of Latin American, Latino and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College. He traveled to El Salvador in late February to continue research for his book now on lockdown in the capital, San Salvador, with his parents. His recent article for Revista, Harvard Review of Latin America, is headlined El Salvador's Two Pandemics, Maximum Insecurity. Also with us in Mexico City is Luis Tillotson, rich researcher for Amnesty International America's co-author of their new report titled Authorities Must Protect People from COVID-19 Instead of Resorting to Repressive Measures. Jorge Cuellar, let's begin with you. Describe what's happening in El Salvador.
Well, thank you for inviting me to the program, Amy. What we're seeing here in San Salvador and El Salvador more broadly is the use of the pandemic in order to keep people in their homes, enforce a militarized lockdown, and to ensure this kind of the non-spreading of the coronavirus. What's very strange about what's going on is that the president has offered very little clarity and transparent information as to what's happening in the quarantines, as the clip that you shared just mentioned. There's things going on there. People are receiving poor treatment with unhygienic conditions, with broken restrooms, for example, in overcrowded conditions that are creating very tense situations within the quarantines that have even led to hunger strikes and protests by individuals.
I want to turn to another clip of a group of men who say they've been illegally detained at one of San Salvador's so-called containment centers for over 45 days. This footage was published also by the Central American Human Rights Organization, one of the men in the group speaking of the conditions inside.
We don't have supplies, which we have been asking for days. Supplies like water, alcohol, gel, soap for the bathroom, and for personal hygiene. We want to reinforce that the food provided by the government arrives here already rotten, causing stomach problems among those of us who are detained here.
So, Jorge Cuellar, if you can talk overall about the government and its use of COVID-19, how it's using it as a pretext for political repression.
So the story of the quarantine really begins back in February, where the president, Nayib Bukele, stormed the national, the Legislative Assembly in order to push for an anti-crime bill called the Territorial Control Plan. And this was one of the first instances when the government started to antagonize other institutions of government and create a sort of a situation where unilateral decision making became sort of the norm. And when the coronavirus sort of takes hold in Central America, Bukele uses this moment in order to sort of double down on those things that he had been pushing for prior. So within the situation of the pandemic, these different sanitary measures that he's taken in order to safeguard the lives of Salvadoran people have come with the increasing number of military and police forces on the ground that have created a series of checkpoints all over the country, as well as kind of creating a certain climate of intimidation for people who are seeking to do their daily errands, to go to the pharmacy, to do their grocery runs. With this kind of idea, given the history of the country and the tense situation among security forces and the general population, that they run the risk of going to or being sent to one of these quarantines that, as those clips also mentioned, are in complete disrepair. There's a likelier chance that one will be infected by the coronavirus within these containment centers than just, staying and remaining home. Louis, so it's this kind of... Yeah, go ahead.
Let me bring Louise Tillotson into the conversation, one of the researchers on this new Amnesty International report called Authorities Must Protect People from COVID-19 Instead of Resorting to Repressive Measures. As you look at what's happening in Latin America, talk about what you're seeing, not only in El Salvador, but around the region.
Yeah, thank you. At Amnesty International, we started documenting incidents of repression in the context of COVID-19 with our digital verification team and country researchers just a few days after the lockdowns were put in place across the region. So in a 7-week period, we documented some 60 instances of repression in a number of countries. We saw 4 worrying trends. In some countries, we've seen detention being used massively as a form to enforce lockdowns. So in places like the Dominican Republic, to date, we've seen some 60,000 people detained. The videos show us that people are simply rounded up and put in the back of police trucks without physical distancing measures. We're not clear what happens to them when they're detained, whether they have access to a lawyer and all the other safeguards one would need to see usually when people are being detained. We also saw many videos of humiliating and degrading treatment by the police. So one of the things that started to emerge in the videos we saw from across the region was the police punishing people with these humiliating tactics of sort of getting them to do jumping jacks and forced group exercise and sometimes using tasers on them. We also saw indications of excess use of force by the police for people that were protesting for access to food and other basic needs. So places like Venezuela, we saw, indigenous communities protesting in need of food and repression being used against them. And as we're also hearing, and in the videos that you showed, in many countries, and in El Salvador, in Venezuela, but also in other Central American countries and in Paraguay, we're seeing this phenomenon of mandatory quarantines in inhumane conditions, as you describe, where people don't have basic sanitation and people are not being tested. So all the videos that we looked at indicate to us that people that are living poverty, homeless people, migrants and refugees are much more likely to be impacted by these punitive measures. And so we're seeing that COVID-19, like other pandemics before it, magnifies structural discrimination. And sadly, it's often the most marginalized that are the first targets of these punitive responses.
And Luis Tillotson, where you are in Mexico City, in Mexico, what has been the response of AMLO, the president of Andrés Manuel López Obrador?
Here in Mexico, we've seen a softer lockdown than in other parts of the region, in the sense that we haven't seen mass deployment of police and military to enforce it. We have seen some incidents of repression that are concerning, but our main focus has been on the issue of violence against women. Of course, there's another epidemic in Latin America, and that holds true here in Mexico, and that's violence against women. So just in March, before lockdowns or stay-at-home orders were put in place, tens of thousands of women here in Mexico took to the streets, demanding that the authorities do more around femicides, do more around domestic violence. And then what we've seen since the stay-at-home orders have been in place is the number of calls to hotlines for domestic violence spike significantly. We haven't seen leadership from the president on this issue. We've called on the authorities in these difficult times to make sure that they provide enough resources to protect survivors from gender-based violence.
I wanted to go back to Professor Cuellar. The Salvadoran president, Bukele, last month authorized police and military to use lethal force against alleged gang members following a spate of homicides allegedly linked to gang activity. Authorities said more than 50 people were murdered in a single weekend after imprisoned suspected gang members allegedly ordered the killings from behind bars. Shocking images, many of which were shared on Bukele's own Twitter account, show prisoners crammed together with only some wearing face masks as prisons enforce, and we're going to show a photograph, it's unbelievable, around-the-clock lockdown on suspected gang members, which includes putting metal sheets over prison bars and housing prisoners from rival gangs in the same overcrowded cells. You have these images of like 1,000 men with each of them in the legs of the one before, and we're going to show that image again. If you could respond to this, the video.
Yeah, that image and those videos of that day are instructive as to what's happening in the country, where there is a kind of security initiative that's taking place during the coronavirus pandemic. And what we see in these images is that there's clearly no way that social distancing can happen within the decrepit and dungeon-like prison system in El Salvador. And these men, like you notice, have very little protection on. But these images, what they did with how they functioned in society is that they demonstrated to the country that indeed the security initiatives that Bukele has set into motion have been effective in curtailing the violence against gangs. Though what we see with this kind of homicide spike that happened in late April was that the territorial control that the government thinks that they've achieved is actually quite fragile and perhaps not true. This ongoing kind of tension between gangs and the state is something that has also been historically present in different administrations that have often used images of gang member humiliation to push this idea that punitive measures are the only option to correct the most undesirable elements of Salvadoran society. But what we see here is this kind of overwhelming dehumanization of these people who are now under this idea that putting them together in the same cells and shutting them off from even seeing sunlight as the center Osiris Luna, the director of the penal system, mentioned, is really not gonna solve the problem in the long term.
Louise Tillotson, as the epicenter of the global pandemic shifts from the United States to Latin America, what are you calling for? What is Amnesty International calling for on the authorities around the issue of police repression using COVID-19 as a pretext?
Yeah, we're concerned by this sort of creeping repression that we're seeing. Of course, in international human rights law, countries can take measures to protect public health. But sadly, in a region where we saw excess use of force by the police consistently in 2019, including during states of emergency, used as a way to repress dissent, we're worried. Governments have extraordinary powers in the current context. Of course, COVID-19 presents us with huge challenges, but measures that governments take, including in mandatory quarantines and enforcement of lockdowns, need to be necessary and proportionate, because beyond the fact that these measures can be repressive and violate a number of human rights, they also stand to undermine prevention efforts. So when people are detained in mass, like we've seen in the Dominican Republic, or put in these obligatory mandatory quarantines like we've seen in El Salvador, in Venezuela, in Paraguay, where they can't physically distance, that's counterproductive to all our efforts. So we've launched a campaign called Repression is Not Protection, and we'll be monitoring states to ensure that they don't overreach or abuse their powers and continue repressing in the name of COVID.
Louise Tillotson, we want to thank you for being with us. Amnesty International Americas will link to your report. Authorities must protect people from COVID-19 instead of resorting to repressive measures. And Professor Jorge Cuellar, thanks so much for joining us from El Salvador. We'll link to your article, El Salvador's Two Pandemics, Maximum Insecurity. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, President Trump has just issued an executive order after Twitter deletes one of his tweets and now has flagged another saying it's promoting violence. They didn't delete it, but they said that his tweet was promoting this information. Stay with us. By the Jacksons. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, President Trump signed an executive order directing federal agencies to clarify the scope of a law known as Section 230, which protects internet companies from liability for illegal content posted by users and lets them remove legal but objectionable posts. Critics say the order could be used to punish social media companies for how they monitor content. This comes as Trump used Twitter to attack civilians protesting the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, calling them thugs and inciting violence by saying, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Twitter responded by labeling Trump's tweet with the warning, this tweet violated the Twitter rules about glorifying violence. However, Twitter has determined that it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible, unquote. This comes after Twitter on Tuesday took the unprecedented step of adding a fact-check label to two tweets of the president of the United States, saying he erroneously attacked mail-in voting. For more, we go to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Ramesh Srinivasan, a professor in the Department of Information Studies and Design Director at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, where he also directs the Digital Cultures Lab. So can you talk about what Twitter has done and what this executive order means, Ramesh?
Yeah, absolutely. And such an honor to join you, Amy. So Trump and Twitter are very strange bedfellows. Trump has long extolled Twitter and other social media platforms as his way of so-called reaching the people. He has over 80 million Twitter followers. So in this particular case, what we see is Trump being personally affronted by Twitter actually enacting something that it warned us it would do, which is actually labeling some of Trump's tweets. That's not a violation of his freedom of speech. That's actually labeling some of his tweets because they are indeed misleading. Trump has prospered through his use of social media and its attention-hoarding algorithms to basically disinform and misinform people. As we know, and you've reported for such a long time, Amy, conspiracy theories and the politicization, for example, of the coronavirus are all occurring online algorithmically in ways that support Trump's agenda.
The American Civil Liberties Union tweeted, "The president has no authority to rewrite a congressional statute with an executive order imposing a flawed interpretation of Section 230. Section 230 incentivizes platforms to host all sorts of content without fear of being held liable. It enables speech, not censorship," said the ACLU. And Jamil Jaffer, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, tweeted, "Whatever else this executive order may be, it is not a good faith effort to protect free speech online." Ramesh Srinivasan.
Absolutely, that is true. However, what Trump has done is actually raise a question that I think we all need to get around, which is really the question of how it is that our online media companies, which are the gateways to all things journalistic, have been able to get away with simply publishing all of this content, because they are indeed publishers and they're monetizing all sorts of journalism without any oversight or regulatory activity. And that's why it's extremely important to intervene on every level possible for the public interest, particularly at a time of pandemic, to ensure that actually public interest in an internet that was originally funded by public taxpayer money, where all the benefits and value and profits and so on have been privatized. So I think it's very important that we actually revisit Section 230 in the image of people's interests and public power. Otherwise, we see these conspiracy theories that are politicizing a situation where 100,000 people have died and not really allowing us to come together in the way we really, really need to as Americans and people across the world.
So the New York Times ran an article with the headline, "Trump's proposed order on social media could harm one person in particular, Trump." How has Trump himself benefited from the Section 230 policy? If you can talk about the lawsuit that tech companies could bring and what this all means, especially as we lead into this election in November, if in fact it takes place.
Yeah, these are huge issues that are occurring here. Again and again and again, we see big tech, basically like big pharma and other sorts of corporate initiatives in America, basically make a great amounts of money off of the backs of American public taxpayers and privatize all the profits. And as they engage in their own private and unaccountable abuses, the costs are re-socialized onto all of us. It's why I've called for a digital bill of rights. So as we approach toward 2020, it's extremely important we recognize that Trump's entire digital strategy game, you can see it with Brad Parscale as his campaign manager, is going to fundamentally focus on online, specifically on Facebook. Hundreds of millions of dollars potentially going to be put into the digital ecosystem. And what is that going to do? Well, it's going to behaviorally micro-target people. We're going to be subject to algorithms that are optimized for our attention, which we know conspiracy-oriented content and sensational-oriented content really glue us and lock us into. So what we really, really need to do is intervene here in every manner possible.
What about these tech companies suing?
Yeah. So the tech companies themselves are very likely to engage in some sorts of counter activity to actually stop Trump with this particular decision. It's very unlikely to stand up this decision in relation to Section 230. It's very unlikely that Trump's act, executive order, will stand up in the courts. So in that sense, it's a distraction, but it points us to the real issue, which is private power dominating public interests involving technology.
Could Twitter delete Trump's account?
Twitter could potentially, but I don't think they're going to engage in that task. I think what they're actually going to do is continue to label his tweets in this particular way, but we're going to see continued backlashes accordingly as well.
Ramesh Srinivasan, we have to have you back on, but I want to thank you for being with us, professor in the Department of Information Studies, design director at UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. If you want to sign up for our daily quarantine report, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Adriana Contreras, Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.